For those of us who were totally swept up by her first novel, The Time Traveler's Wife, Audrey Niffenegger is back now with her second. It's called Her Fearful Symmetry, and it's a ghost story. Two young Americans, Julia and Valentina Poole, come to live in London. They're identical twins and unusually close. 21 years old, though, as Niffenegger writes, they were often mistaken for undernourished 12-year-olds. They've come to live in an apartment next to a cemetery. The flat was left to them by their aunt, Elspeth Noblin, who dies straight off in the first line of the book.
I have finally managed to achieve total efficiency in killing a character.
In the very first line of the book.
Yeah.
Well, tell us about the ghost story part of this and how that came to you.
Well, it would be somewhat unlikely and ridiculous for two 21-year-olds to be living by themselves in a stupendous flat in this particular part of London. It's a very expensive neighborhood. And so I was thinking, well, how can I get them there? And one of the things I'm doing in this book is taking all the old clichés and the workings of the 19th century English novel and trying to use them in a 21st century novel in a way that they make sense. And so, reaching into the big bag of clichés, I decided that they had a rich relative who would die and leave them this flat. And the more I thought about their aunt, Elspeth, the more interested I got in her and the more I wanted to write about her, and I felt very, very sorry that I had killed her before she even got into the story. And so I started to move backward and finally arrived at the point where she dies, which is the thing that sets everything else in motion in this story, and decided that she would not go, she would become a ghost. And she's a very willful character, and it is her willfulness that stops her from simply dying and propels her into this limbo between life and death.
We should talk about, I think, what is fairly considered to be a real character in the book, and that is Highgate Cemetery in London, which is where Elspeth Noblin is buried. Tell us about Highgate.
Well, Highgate, of course, is a real place. It was started in 1839, and it's in an especially beautiful part of London. The Victorians decided that it would be okay to have these park-like cemeteries, and they're quite lovely. People came out and picnicked, and it was a beautiful place. Also, the city was very polluted, and Highgate's on a hill, so people would come out and get fresh air. And over the years, it filled up with all sorts of super amazing, interesting people, some of whom we've heard of, Karl Marx, Christina Rossetti, some of whom we haven't, but their life stories are fascinating. And I've been giving tours of the cemetery. In the process of researching my tour guide character, Robert, I had accumulated the knowledge set you need to actually give a tour. And so the people who run the cemetery noticed, and they said, well, make yourself useful.
There is so much death all through the novel, and to some extent also in The Time Traveler's Wife. Are you sort of playing with the aesthetics of death? I've been looking at a lot of your visual art online, too, and there are lots of drawings and prints of skeletons and sort of death iconography. What is that about?
I think I must have sprung from the womb looking at the other end of my life. I've always been interested in it. All the art that I was attracted to when I was young seemed to be, if not macabre, at least involving loss in some way.
Well, what do you think it is about death and dying and ghosts and cemeteries that has this appeal for you?
They're beautiful, which I know seems perverse since a lot of the time it's anything but. Violence does not especially attract me, nor do I try to aestheticize it. I take violence very seriously, and I'm not really too interested in making it into my art. Death, on the other hand, is something that will eventually happen to everybody, and it does seem important to think about it.
Did you ever find, when you were writing Her Fearful Symmetry, that you felt you had to pull back a bit, that maybe the death themes were too much and you might alienate your audience some?
Certainly, I think there are people who enjoyed Time Traveler who may not like this as well. This book is more astringent and less of a full-blown romantic odyssey I tried in this book not to be relentless. There is humor in the book, and there are open spaces where I'm not necessarily determining something, where it's possible for the reader to make choices about what's happening and how they're going to think about what the characters are doing.
Well, Audrey Niffenegger, thank you very much. Egger, thank you very much.
Thank you so much. It was such a pleasure.
Audrey Niffenegger's new novel is titled Her Fearful Symmetry. You can read an excerpt and see a couple of her macabre drawings at npr.org.
The writer Richard Russo likes to go for morning coffee with his wife at a place where they can watch hordes of commuters spill out of a train station in Boston.
My wife and I have very different reactions to that. She's had very good experiences in offices. For her, the office is a place of camaraderie, of kind of shared purpose. Whereas I, on the other hand, as I watch these people all dressed up coming across the street and disappearing up into these glass towers, that's my idea of hell.
Russo says that dread might come from the stories he's read. One American novelist after another has painted a grim picture of the American office.
Richard Russo is the latest writer we've asked to review a few books. The author of Empire Falls and That Old Cape Magic chose fiction about the workplace, some old, some new. The books include a 2007 novel by Joshua Ferris called Then We Came to the End.
The novel begins with a group of copywriters and artists who work in an ad agency. And there's an economic downturn, and they begin to start getting laid off. They all complain bitterly about their work. They believe that their employment is keeping them in some way from being the better human beings that they would be if they weren't employed. Once the layoffs hit, a kind of ironic truth begins to come home to all of them, which is that they hate their jobs. And yet the thing that they are most terrified of is losing them, despite the fact that almost all of these people in the novel have some other kind of alternate version of themselves out there. There's a fellow named Hank Neary who's got a novel in his desk. He's described as a failed novelist. And there's a painter in there. So the art people, they all have dreams of doing something else. And yet something is preventing them from doing so.
And these characters who have big dreams end up arguing over who owns the office furniture as the previous owners get fired.
Yeah, that's one of the things that Ferris really brings to the fore is the way offices skew important things and inconsequential things. Important things like someone's health, for instance. There's a character named Lynn who is going in the next day for a mastectomy. These things become inconsequential, but trying to track down who has stolen what bookshelf becomes of tremendous importance.
Now, what caused you also to recommend to us a book here called Personal Days by Ed Park?
Well, Personal Days is, strangely enough, despite its hilarity and its satire, also has a little bit of a mystery. There's a wonderful character named Jill who is, before she is finally fired, she is exiled to a totally different floor. She's the only one up there. And she, at first she begins to think that she's losing her mind, and her emails down to her all of her colleagues from whom she's been banished on the floor below become more and more bizarre. But people don't want to go up. They don't want to visit her. They're ashamed, and they're a little scared of what's becoming of her. And when she finally is fired, they go up and they discover that she's been writing something. She's just up there constructing a work of fiction.
When you talk about alienation and people who don't fit in and who are exiled, maybe that's a perfect transition to the writing of Richard Yates from several decades ago, which you also direct to our attention here.
Yeah. And the work of Yates that everybody knows, of course, is Revolutionary Road, the story of Frank Wheeler and April Wheeler. The office in Richard Yates is where dreams go to die. Well, that and suburbia, and these two things are happening in America in lockstep. There's a section in Revolutionary Road where Frank is going into Grand Central Station. That I'll just, if you'll indulge me for a moment, it's a very short passage.
Please, this is the giant commuter rail.
And he comes into Grand Central, and this was done very well in the movie too. All those men in fedoras coming down that escalator, all looking so very much like each other. How small and neat and comically serious the other men looked with their gray flecked crew cuts and their button-down collars and their brisk little hurrying feet. They were endless, desperate swarms of them hurrying through the station and the streets, and an hour from now they would all be still. The waiting midtown office buildings would swallow them up and contain them so that to stand in one tower looking across the canyon to another would be to inspect a great silent insectarium displaying hundreds of tiny pink men in white shirts, forever shifting papers and frowning into telephones, acting out their passionate little dumb show under the supreme indifference of the rolling spring clouds. Mm.
One of the amazing things about that passage, Richard Russo, is that the man observing this, Frank Wheeler, although he feels for a moment that he's escaped, that he's different from all those people he's sort of mocking there, he's kind of one of them, isn't he?
He certainly is. And we see the seeds of all of this, I think. This may not be the first American office story, but it is certainly a significant one, going back to, I think it's 1853, with Herman Melville's Bartleby the Scrivener. He reproduces documents almost flawlessly, and he seems to be able to work hours and hours and hours on end. There's only one problem. when he's asked to become part of a team, Bartleby utters that line that will echo throughout American literature for a couple hundred years. He says, "I would prefer not to." He gives no reason. He doesn't object to the work. In fact, he doesn't object to anything. He would just prefer not to. And so the question becomes, what happens in an office when you have an individual who would prefer not to? What if there isn't really a shared sense of purpose?
And in the end, this is something that threatens to wreck the office, if I'm not mistaken, to the point where they end up moving the office to get away from him.
It's what happens is when you get this worker who has a kind of Emersonian sense of self-reliance, the office is doomed.
Richard Russo is the author of a number of novels, including That Old Cape Magic. Thanks very much.
I enjoyed it.
When this country's first female Secretary of State practiced diplomacy, she did it with tact, toughness, and costume jewelry. In the Clinton administration, Madeleine Albright became known for the pins she wore. Now she's written about them. NPR special correspondent Susan Stamberg speaks with Secretary Albright about her new book, Read My Pins.
Madeleine Albright, here we are in the middle of North Korea, problems in Iran, problems in Iraq, problems in Afghanistan, and you and I are going to sit down and talk about pins.
Well, I'll tell you why we are, because I use them as a tool of diplomacy.
Well, you stick people with them, you put the unclasped pin.
No, but I'll tell you, this all started when I was ambassador at the United Nations. Saddam Hussein called me a serpent, and I had this wonderful antique snake pin. And so when we were dealing with Iraq, I wore the snake pin. So I thought, well, this is fun. So then I went out and I bought a bunch of costume jewelry to signal what my mood of the day was.
And the signals were caught by people like Vladimir Putin, who told President Clinton, right, that he would know what the mood of a meeting was going to be by taking a look at your, which shoulder is it, your left shoulder?
My left shoulder. And you know what I did? When we went for the summit, it was right after all the things that I thought were so terrible in Chechnya that the Russians wouldn't admit to. So I wore the three monkeys, the hear no evil, see no evil, speak no evil monkeys, which was that they were not seeing what was going on in Chechnya.
There are also wasps.
There are wasps. There are wasps on days that I wanted to do a little stinging and deliver a tough message.
And you spoke through jewelry.
Well, one of the tools, you know. I use that as a way of signaling certain things, but then obviously we had to do a lot of very tough talking or nice talking.
So today you have a, they're not real, I bet you, either. Pardon me, but you
definitely
do say
not.
You don't buy expensive stuff. You've got rubies, you've got emeralds, it's an elephant.
Now, I am not changing parties. That is not what this is about. I taught today, and we were doing a segment on bilateral diplomacy, and it was U.S.-India relations, so I thought it would be fun to wear an elephant.
You had protest pins that you would wear from time to time.
The best, I think, was the Russians had actually bugged the State Department. At a certain period, we discovered that there was a bug in one of our conference rooms. So the next time I met with the Russians, I had this huge bug pin. So they got it.
But you would wear a turtle for certain reasons.
Well, I wore turtles and crabs when I was signaling how terribly slowly everything was going in the Middle East peace talks.
And if you were hopeful that a meeting would go the way you wanted it to, or if you felt things were going smoothly.
Well, I had balloons or butterflies. You have on a butterfly today. Or flowers, you know, really happy pins. A sun. I had great sun pins. And I wore a sun, actually, to South Korea because President Kim Dae-jung had a policy called the Sunshine Policy, which was his way of saying that there ought to be better contacts with North Korea. So, as it turned out, there were just a lot of occasions to either commemorate a particular event or to signal how I felt.
You brought some pins with you.
This dove was given to me by Leah Rabin. And it was after her husband had been assassinated and we were doing peace talks and she said, you need a dove. And so I wore that whenever I did a Middle East speech. And then she gave me a necklace of doves and with a note that said, in the Middle East, a dove needs a lot of reinforcement. And this one is a fox.
Oh,
and I have a chapter in the book called Foxy Lady when I'm having a lot of fun and doing a little flirting along the way.
Well, it makes me really wonder about the gender issue involved in your showing up with pins. You know, men, diplomats or not, are not going to look at one another and say, great tie, Harry.
Actually, they do.
Really?
Yes. That's the stunning part. I have to tell you, Susan, there are so many times that there is the beginning of some diplomatic conversation, and you think that the heads of state only have serious conversations. They actually often begin either with the weather or really like your tie.
Some kind of icebreaker.
Yeah.
So then it wouldn't diminish you in some way as a woman coming in with the pin, asking for notice that way?
Well, I'll tell you what I decided. I love being a woman, and I, in the way I dressed and in the way I carry myself, and so I think that, no, I don't mind.
Your pins came close to sabotaging you, or at least one did, at your swearing-in ceremony when you became Secretary of State.
I went to buy some things, and so the owner of the jewelry store said to me, I have this fabulous pin for you. It is an eagle. So I bought it. And there I am. I decided to wear it to my swearing in. But it was an antique pin with a very complicated clasp. So I put it on, and there I was all of a sudden with one hand on the Bible and one hand in the air, and I looked, and the pin was just swinging in the breeze. I had not fastened it properly. The pin is just kind of hanging there. I was afraid it would fall on the Bible. It was a complicated.
But also, how symbolic is that? I mean, about the precariousness of the job that you were about to
start. I hadn't thought about that, but you're absolutely right. That's very good.
And the precariousness of foreign policy and getting along in this world and getting countries to agree when they really don't want to, all of it.
Right. But I think that it's a sign that one has to really try to understand the people that you're working with and develop some. There's a balance between developing personal relations and never forgetting what the national interest of your country is, and really trying to develop a eye-to-eye contact with the people that you're working with, trying to find out who they are, and trying to find out what they want and what you have to have. So that's what diplomacy is.
Thank you very much. Madeleine Albright was this country's ambassador to the United Nations and then Secretary of State. Her new book, full of color photos, is called Read My Pins. I'm Susan Stamberg, NPR News.
Some of Secretary Albright's pins are on exhibit at the Museum of Arts and Design in New York City. If you'd like to see some of Madeleine Albright's favorite pins right now, including the gold serpent pin that started the tradition, go to our website, npr.org.